Chapter 17 of My Mark Twain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 17. A little after this, Clemens went abroad with his family and lived several years in Germany. His letters still came, but at longer intervals, and the thread of our intimate relations was inevitably broken. He would write me when something I had written pleased him, or when something signal occurred to him, or some political or social outrage stirred him to wrath, and he wished to free his mind in pious profanity. During this sojourn he came near dying of pneumonia in Berlin, and he had slight relapses from it after coming home. In Berlin, also, he had the honor of dining with the German emperor at the table of a cousin married to a high officer of the court. Clemens was a man to enjoy such a distinction. He knew how to take it as a delegated recognition from the German people. But as coming from a rather cock-a-hoop sovereign, who had as yet only his sovereignty to value himself upon, he was not very proud of it. He expressed a quiet disdain of the event as between the imperiality and himself, on whom it was supposed to confer such glory, crowning his life with the topmost leaf of laurel. He was in the same mood, in his account, of an English dinner party many years before, where there was a little Scotch lord present, to whom the English tacitly referred Clemens' talk, and laughed when the lord laughed, and were grave when he failed to smile. Of all the men I have known, he was the farthest from a snob, though he valued recognition, and liked the flattery of the fashionable fair when it came in his way. He would not go out of his way for it, but, like most able and brilliant men, he loved the minds of women, their wit, their agile cleverness, their sensitive perception, their humorous appreciation, the saucy things they would say, and their pretty, temerarious defiances. He had, of course, the keenest sense of what was truly dignified and truly undignified in people, but he was not really interested in what we call society affairs. They scarcely existed for him, though his books witness how he abhorred the dreadful fools who, through some chance of birth or wealth, hold themselves different from other men. Commonly, he did not keep things to himself, especially dislikes and condemnations. Upon most current events, he had strong opinions, and he uttered them strongly. After a while he was silent in them, but if you tried him, you found him in them still. He was tremendously worked up by a certain famous trial, as most of us were who lived in the time of it. He believed the accused guilty, but when we met some months after it was over, and I tempted him to speak his mind upon it, he would only say, "The man had suffered enough," as if the man had expiated his wrong, and he was not going to do anything to renew his penalty. I found that very curious, very delicate. His continued blame could not come to the sufferer's knowledge, but he felt it his duty to forbear it. He was apt to wear himself out in the vehemence of his resentments, or he had so spent himself in uttering them that he had literally nothing more to say. You could offer Clemens offenses that would anger other men, and he did not mind. He would account for them from human nature. But if he thought you had in any way played him false, you were anathema and maranatha forever. Yet not forever. Perhaps, for by and by, after years, he would be silent. There were two men, half a generation apart in their succession, whom he thought equally atrocious in their treason to him, and of whom he used to talk terrifyingly, even after they were out of the world. He went farther than Heine, who said that he forgave his enemies, but not till they were dead. Clemens did not forgive his dead enemies. Their death seemed to deepen their crimes, like a base evasion or a cowardly attempt to escape. He pursued them to the grave. He would like to dig them up and take vengeance upon their clay. So he said, but no doubt he would not have hurt them if he had them living before him. He was generous without stint. He trusted without measure. But where his generosity was abused or his trust betrayed, he was a fire of vengeance, a consuming flame of suspicion that no sprinkling of cool patience from others could quench. It had to burn itself out. He was eagerly and lavishly hospitable, but if a man seemed willing to batten on him, or in any way to lie down upon him, Clemens despised him unutterably. In his frenzies of resentment or suspicion, he would not, and doubtless could not, listen to reason. But if between the paroxysms he were confronted with the facts, he would own them, no matter how much they told against him. At one period he fancied that a certain newspaper was hounding him with biting censure and poisonous paragraphs, and he was filling himself up with wrath to be duly discharged on the editor's head. Later, he wrote me with a humorous joy in his mistake that Warner had advised him to have the paper watched for these injuries. He had done so, and how many mentions of him did I reckon he had found in 3 months? Just two, and they were rather indifferent than unfriendly. So the paper was acquitted, and the editor's life was spared. The wretch never knew how near he was to losing it, with incredible preliminaries of obloquy and a subsequent devotion to lasting infamy. His memory for favors was as good as for injuries, and he liked to return your friendliness with as loud a band of music as could be bought or bribed for the occasion. All that you had to do was to signify that you wanted his help. When my father was consul at Toronto during Arthur's administration, he fancied that his place was in danger, and he appealed to me. In turn, I appealed to Clemens, bethinking myself of his friendship with Grant and Grant's friendship with Arthur. I asked him to write to Grant in my father's behalf. "But no," he answered me, "I must come to Hartford, and we would go on to New York together and see Grant personally." This was before, and long before, Clemens became Grant's publisher and splendid benefactor. But the men liked each other, as such men could not help doing. Clemens made the appointment, and we went to find Grant in his business office, that place where his business innocence was afterwards so betrayed. He was very simple and very cordial, and I was instantly the more at home with him because his voice was the soft, rounded Ohio River accent to which my ears were earliest used from my steamboating uncles, my earliest heroes. When I stated my business, he merely said, "Oh, no, that must not be. He would write to Mr. Arthur," and he did so that day. And my father lived to lay down his office, when he tired of it, with no urgence from above. It is not irrelevant to Clemens to say that Grant seemed to like finding himself in company with two literary men, one of whom, at least, he could make sure of, and, unlike that silent man he was reputed, he talked constantly, and, so far as he might, he talked literature. At least, he talked of John Phoenix, that delightfulest of the early Pacific Slope humorists, whom he had known under his real name of George H. Derby, when they were fellow cadets at West Point. It was mighty pretty, as Pepys would say, to see the delicate deference Clemens paid our plain hero, and the manly respect with which he listened. While Grant talked, his luncheon was brought in from some unassuming restaurant nearby, and he asked us to join him in the baked beans and coffee which were served us in a little room out of the office with about the same circumstance as at a railroad refreshment counter. The baked beans and coffee were of about the railroad refreshment quality, but eating them with Grant was like sitting down to baked beans and coffee with Julius Caesar or Alexander or some other great Plutarchan captain. One of the highest satisfactions of Clemens' often supremely satisfactory life was his relation to Grant. It was his proud joy to tell how he found Grant about to sign a contract for his book on certainly very good terms, and said to him that he would himself publish the book and give him a percentage 3 times as large. He said Grant seemed to doubt whether he could honorably withdraw from the negotiation at that point, but Clemens overbore his scruples, and it was his unparalleled privilege, his princely pleasure, to pay the author a far larger check for his work than had ever been paid to an author before. He valued even more than this splendid opportunity the sacred moments in which their business brought him into the presence of the slowly dying, heroically living man whom he was so befriending. And he told me in words which surely lost none of their simple pathos, through his report, how Grant described his suffering. The prosperity of this venture was the beginning of Clemens' adversity, for it led to excesses of enterprise which were forms of dissipation. The young sculptor who had come back to him from Paris modeled a small bust of Grant, which Clemens multiplied in great numbers, to his great loss, and the success of Grant's book tempted him to launch on publishing seas where his bark presently foundered. The first and greatest of his disasters was the life of Pope Leo XIII, which he came to tell me of when he had imagined it in a sort of delirious exultation. He had no words in which to paint the magnificence of the project or to forecast its colossal success. It would have a currency bounded only by the number of Catholics in Christendom. It would be translated into every language which was anywhere written or printed. It would be circulated literally in every country of the globe, and Clemens' book agents would carry the prospectuses and then the bound copies of the work to the ends of the whole earth. Not only would every Catholic buy it, but every Catholic must, as he was a good Catholic, as he hoped to be saved. It was a magnificent scheme, and it captivated me, as it had captivated Clemens. It dazzled us both, and neither of us saw the fatal defect in it. We did not consider how often Catholics could not read, how often, when they could, they might not wish to read. The event proved that, whether they could read or not, the immeasurable majority did not wish to read the life of the Pope, though it was written by a dignitary of the Church and issued to the world with every sanction from the Vatican. The failure was incredible to Clemens. His sanguine soul was utterly confounded, and soon a silence fell upon it where it had been so exuberantly jubilant. End of chapter 17. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California for LibriVox. Winter 2006.